This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello and welcome to Radio Astronomy, the podcast from the makers of BBC Sky and Eye magazine. My name is Kev Lochin and I'm joined today by the familiar voices of news editor Elizabeth Pearson.
Hi.
And editorial assistant Ian Todd.
Hello.
Now guys, I just want to start off by throwing you a curveball. If you could name a moon after any character from literature, what would it be?
I don't know. And besides, all of the names have been taken by moons already.
All the names.
All of the names have been taken. Yes.
Right, okay. We'll leave that as you can't think of any literature at all right now. You guys doing...
Actually, I am going to say, whenever I think of the moon, I always think of the Tintin story where he flies to the moon. Call it Snowy.
Tintin and Snowy, okay.
Yes.
We'll go with those. Exciting month.
Yeah, pretty much. We managed to get to the International Astronomy Show this month. We went up there a couple of weeks back, talked to some readers. I spent far too much money on shiny space rocks.
Excellent.
So it was a good weekend.
Yeah, and exciting month in space news as well.
Yeah.
Lots of things happening. Rosetta softly crashing into its comet. A planned impact.
Yes.
Whereas
got it right this time.
Yes, whereas the other one we want to talk about is
ExoMars. Well, Schiaparelli,
yeah.
Specifically.
Quite so.
That one didn't go so well.
No. So the lander, the orbiter inserted itself into Martian orbit happily.
Yes, the Trace Gas Orbiter, otherwise known as TGO, absolutely fine, did everything it was supposed to. They're very keen at ESA to let everybody know that that was exactly what was supposed to happen.
But?
Yes.
The rover, it detached successfully? They detached
it
separately?
It wasn't a rover.
Sorry,
it was a lander.
You're right, it's a lander.
Important.
Very.
Yeah.
I don't know any wheels.
I think it's like an entry, descent, and landing module.
EDM, yeah.
Yeah. The purpose of the lander really was, it wasn't, I think it only had enough batteries to last for about 4 Martian days or something like that.
It's somewhere between 4 and 12, which
right.
is quite a big gap, but they weren't 100% sure how well it was going to do.
And I think although it was going to be carrying out some science, its main objective was basically as a test, as a preparation for ExoMars 2020, which will land a rover. It was basically just to kind of prove that ESA and Roscosmos could land, what might potentially be a rover on Mars, which I suppose,
It hasn't really quite worked out. So what went wrong?
So it seems that for the first couple of minutes, everything went fine. The lander got to the atmosphere, went through the first couple of layers, slowed down, did everything it was supposed to. The parachute deployed, and that deployed exactly as it was supposed to. Unfortunately, the parachute, because the atmosphere around Mars is so thin, that could only slow it down to, I think it was about 200 kilometers per hour. And then a couple of kilometers above the surface, what was supposed to happen was retro rockets, or thrusters on the bottom, were supposed to kind of kick in and slowly guide it towards the surface.
Is this similar to the Curiosity sky crane?
Yeah, it's exactly the same principle. Something... the current time, they don't know what that something is, but something went wrong. And the thrusters, they were supposed to be going for about 50 seconds, they cut out after, 2.
Oh.
Which meant that rather than being carefully guided down to the surface, it dropped between 2 and 4 kilometres, impacting the surface at about 300 kilometres per hour.
So it gained speed.
Yeah, it gained speed because it was in free fall.
So did the parachute drop before the thrusters?
Yes, so the parachute detached again, just like it was supposed to do. And that was all fine. So that bit is of it. It's just for some reason the thrusters cut out, and that's what they're going to spend the next however long it takes trying to work out why that happened. Also, because the thrusters cut out, it means that the fuel tanks were full when it impacted.
Right.
Which means that there was probably quite a spectacular explosion when it actually hit, because they would have ignited.
Wow.
So, yes.
It's one of these stories that kind of each day you look at it, there seems to be something different. I think like the initial, one of the initial things they were saying was that the heat shield fell off or something like that, and that didn't protect it. And then I read today that the parachute actually jettisoned too early.
Mm.
But it's potentially one of these things that even by the time this podcast comes out, there'll be a completely different story because they're still kind of gathering data.
Yeah, they considered the test a success, in inverted commas, because they got all of the engineering data. So the EDM was transmitting back to Earth as it was going through its descent. So they have all of that information, which should, in time, tell them exactly what happened and exactly what went wrong. Which, for when you, that's why you run tests, because sometimes tests go well, sometimes they don't go so well, and it's just making sure you've got that information so you can work out what went wrong so it doesn't happen next time when you've got the big expensive rover.
Also, interestingly, we got some images from the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter in the last few days that appear to show, anyway, the parachute and the lander itself. Essentially, ESA released a comparison of a patch of Mars taken, I think, maybe 6 months apart. And obviously, two new dots have appeared, one of which is potentially the parachute and one of which is potentially the lander.
Mm. So did the lander bounce? What did it do with
Eli? Bits of it probably did. I think that they're kind of analysing as you said, with the MRO, the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, there's a sort of black splat. And they're going to be looking at that and trying to work out exactly kind of what happened when it impacted.
This always hallmarks of Beagle, doesn't it?
Mm.
Yeah.
Mars Express lander that one did land.
Yes.
But didn't unfurl. But it spent years looking for that one.
Yeah. Went wrong at the final hurdle. I think that was found by MRO as
it
well?
It was. Same one.
Last year, I think.
But you're right, that one, it touched down, but it didn't unfurl its solar panels correctly, if I remember correctly.
I think it was the last one, which they had very cleverly put the transmission antenna on the final petal, I think they called it. And that's now on one of the list of things to check, does the thing need to deploy fully in order to get the transmission? And if the answer to that is yes, then it's not a very good space probe.
Ah.
It's one of ESA's checklists.
Beagle 2 was obviously one of the first things that sprung to our mind because it was a kind of UK-led mission. But I was also looking at kind of other failed Mars missions, and one of the ones that really caught my attention was Phobos 1, which is the USSR space probe in 1988. And apparently, it was supposed to be an unmanned spacecraft that was going to explore Mars, basically.
When you say it was supposed to be an unmanned, does that mean someone climbed into it at the last moment?
Sorry, let me correct myself. It was an unmanned spacecraft that was supposed to be exploring Mars, but apparently a technician who was sending up a command to it left out a hyphen.
Right.
And all the commands were supposed to be proofread by computers, but the computer wasn't working. I think the technician knew that the computer wasn't working, but sent up the command anyway. And the spacecraft read it as, oh, that's the end of the mission, and just shut off everything.
And
that
was
lost. One hyphen.
Yeah, there's another one that quite famously something like that happened, which was the Mars Climate Orbiter back in 1999. And I've heard various conflicting things about this, but I actually looked up what happened with this one, which they sent a command to it, and it was supposed to change its orbit. Unfortunately, it changed its orbit to be about 100 miles, I think it was, too low in the atmosphere and it burned up. And the reason that that happened was because someone on some piece of software had put it in imperial units rather than in metric units. And so it crashed because of a conversion error, basically.
Oh. And presumably this is another one of things on the spacecraft design checklist,
yes,
along with where is my transmission,
yes,
antenna?
It was supposed to be in, there was some number that was supposed to be in Newton seconds, and instead it was done in pound seconds because that's what the company did. And even though it was said on the specifications it should be in Newton seconds, it just didn't happen and nobody checked. The thing that I think's really weird is, like you said with that guy, with the Russians on Phobos, two people noticed that something wasn't right. They looked at the numbers and said, guys, I don't think this is right, but they just did it anyway.
Yeah.
And it's...
Is it kind of like a faith, and too much faith in the computers themselves?
How long was your list, Ian? You said you were looking at failed Mars missions. Because there is something of a Mars curse I've heard bandied about
there
before.
Yeah,
there were a few other ones that I kind of noted. I mean, I think on the ESA website anyway, it said that like over 40 missions have attempted to land on Mars since 1960. But yeah, there were a few. There was like the Mars 2 was another USSR one in 1971. Mm. It was kind of the same thing. Like the orbiter arrived safely, but the lander, like the landing system, failed and it got lost.
I think it is worth saying that a lot of the ones that failed, it was during, you know, the height of the space race, and people were just like, well, just
get
keep
it up there.
If you send off 20, one of them will make it through.
Yeah,
but that's a valid point itself. It is a numbers game, not just on those missions, but presumably the preponderance of human missions to other planets have been to Mars.
Yeah.
So it is always going to be something of a curse.
Yes. Next will be the curse of Venus or asteroids or comets or whatever it is they decide to do.
Where would you like there to be the next curse of? Where would you like to explore next?
I would like to go see Venus. I'd like to get a bit more up close and personal with Venus, but obviously there's some problems with landing on Venus in the 90 times atmospheric pressure and, you know, sulfuric acid, rain, and it just generally being a bit warm. Can't remember exactly how hot it is, but it's.
I think, what was it?
Enough to melt lead, I think.
Searing hellscape is generally the kind of the way you describe Venus.
But it's an interesting planet, and it is, you know, there's all that evidence coming out that maybe it was once much more habitable, and, you know, that it's the Earth that could have been. And I think that'd be really interesting to go and look at.
Well, I used to think that in the past, back in the days when Mars had canals, that Venus was a lush, verdant, kind of Lost Valley of Dinosaurs kind of place.
It was cloudy because it had weather. Like, if you looked at the Earth, it would look cloudy, and Venus looked cloudy. So, obviously, there's verdant rainforests on it, right?
What about you, Ian?
I'm not really sure. I think, like, as a kid, I've always loved Jupiter because it's kind of so iconic and so recognizable. So I'm really interested in the Juno mission, and I think perhaps that would be an interesting planet to kind of next focus our attentions upon.
I think you're going to get some answers much sooner than Nez ears.
Yeah,
we've got, what was it? You got Juno and Juice.
There's even a Europa mission,
Europa,
which is
Cooper.
Kind of, yes, the next one that NASA is going to start thinking about.
Why is it called Europa Cooper? Because that reminds me of a yacht.
I think that's the idea. It's so much in the sort of planning, in this blue sky thinking phase, to use some business speak.
Please don't.
That there are. It'll probably have a much fancier name later on. It's just that's what they're calling it at the moment.
Incidentally, our dear listeners, you can read more about missions to Europa in the November issue, which is on sale now. Right, we should probably move on. So a bit later on, we're going to hear from the Sky Knight TV show's Pete Lawrence. And also, Ian, you're going to be interviewing aeronautics engineer Dr. Christine Darden, who worked as a human computer at NASA in the 1960s, right?
Yes, it was a group of engineers, either all or mostly women, who essentially did the kind of calculations that enabled America to pursue its space race ambitions. Dr. Christine Darden, she was a human computer in the 1960s, and I Yeah, I spoke to her about her time in NASA.
Awesome. We'll get on to that in a little bit. But right now, I've got three more questions for you in News Bingo.
Yay.
So, News Bingo.
We should have a jingle for News Bingo.
You going to try one now?
News Bingo.
That's stay good. So, News Bingo is where I read you out three questions based on the latest space news stories, and you have to guess what the big news story is I'm talking about. Now, this month, it's three questions, but there's also three bonus questions, so 6 points up for grabs.
So you know there's bonus questions this time.
There are definitely bonus questions. You all have pads in front of you, so you can write your answers down. So let's go on with it. First one, what is a Tychonaut? I get a feeling at least one of you knows this.
Yep.
Cool.
Right, Ian, because I think you're the one who doesn't know, or might not know.
Is it an astronaut from China?
It is.
It's the Chinese word for astronaut.
Absolutely. It is the name that the Chinese give to their astronauts. Now, why would I be asking you about that at this time?
Because of the first mission to Tiangong 2.
Yes, absolutely right. Since our last podcast, China sent two astronauts, or Tychonauts, up to live in its orbital space lab for 30 days. As you rightly say, it's called Tiangong 2, meaning Heavenly Palace 2, and was launched in mid-September 2016. Now, the two astronauts are going to spend their time up there performing experiments, which includes kind of physiological tests on themselves, and horticultural tests, so growing cress, but also growing rice.
Okay.
Now, I didn't know this. I didn't know going to grow rice, but apparently rice takes 4 to 5 months to grow. Well, so
really?
I'm assuming it's going to be just germinating some seeds.
I think they're planning on...
Unless they're leaving it up there, I don't know.
I think they're leaving it up there. They're planning... It's not going to be a permanently inhabited place like the ISS, purely because it's only about sort of 10 metres long.
Yes.
They call it a palace. Not really palatial. But they are planning on having, I think this mission's 33 days. They're going to have more long-term missions going up there as well. It's not designed to be a permanent habitat, but it is going to be up there for at least a couple of years.
Quite right. It's kind of a Skylab equivalent. It's a single module. It's not going to change. But all of this work, this is in preparation for the launch of the first component of a long-term modular space station, which I forget the Chinese name of, but it means Harmony of the Heavens.
Okay.
Because there's going to be 3 Tiangong modules, which is going to launch in the mid-2020s, I think it is.
That's what... That's kind of the best estimate that we have, because China does play their cards close to their chest when it comes to their space plan.
And also, the launches of all of these space labs, they've actually been slipping.
Mm.
So 2020s, maybe end of 2020s, perhaps.
That always happens with space missions, though. It's kind of always add on an extra couple of years, because that's how long it'll actually be.
Oh, precisely.
Do we know whether or not that would be like a collaborative space station, or whether that would only be manned by Tychonauts?
It's been developed entirely by China, because my understanding is it's come out of the fact they're not involved with the ISS.
Yeah.
Mm.
But, I mean, I think it's really interesting to keep an eye on what Tiangong 2 evolves into, because the ISS is running up to 2020, I think, and then it's...
I think it's funded up to 2020... they are hoping to extend it as far as 2024. Potentially could get up to 28, but that's going to be pushing how long they think it can last, and they're hoping to get something else together by then.
As far as the funding up to 2028 might be problematic, are you talking about the integrity of the physical space station?
A little of both. It's was designed to be a long-term but temporary station. It wasn't designed to last for centuries. But the space agencies, they build things to last. You know, Hubble was only supposed to be going for a couple of years, and it's, what, 25, 27 now?
It's past 25, yeah.
Yeah. And Voyager, again, those ones, they've been going for decades. So they can... They're not going to make it run any longer than is safe.
Oh, yeah, of course.
But they are beginning to... Apparently, the stations are beginning to feel their age, and, you know, stuff does break on them. They want to make sure that they're not putting their astronauts and cosmonauts in danger.
Because potentially we could get to a point where the only space station is this Chinese one,
yeah.
Which would be Well, interesting to keep an eye on. Your bonus question for this is, obviously, the astronauts have gone on their 30-day mission to Tiangong 2. What happened to Tiangong 1? Ian's shaking his head.
Yeah, no idea.
Okay.
It's up for grabs, as.
So, again, China hasn't officially stated this, but people have been watching it, and it looks like it's out of control.
Yes.
It was supposed to be deorbited after 2 years. It looked like it went out of control after 4. And I think it's currently slated to burn up in the atmosphere sometime in 2017.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's still up there in space, but its orbit is decaying. It might not be under control. It's not really confirmed, is
yeah.
it? And yeah, it will burn up.
Mm-hmm.
Right, your second / third question, depending on which way you're counting. So, researchers at the University of Idaho have announced that the planet Uranus may have 2 more moons than we thought. Where did the data they used to reach this conclusion come from? And there's a reason I'm asking that, but it will become apparent in a moment.
Now understanding why you asked for names for moons.
All right, go.
Voyager 2?
That is right.
Yeah. I remembered it was a Voyager. I couldn't remember which one.
So, you're right. The data came from Voyager 2 spacecraft. Why I wanted to kind of mention that is that this discovery comes from images that are over 30 years old.
Mm.
So, it hasn't done anything new with Voyager 2. It hasn't sent new photos back from Uranus. It's just they've looked at the photos again and gone, oh, I found something new. So, the moons haven't been seen directly. The moons, which don't have names but are unofficially now Tintin and Snowy. there was a reason. So they haven't been seen directly, but their presence has been inferred from disturbances seen in 2 of the edges of the rings, which resemble waves. So they believe these disturbances have been caused by 2 moons that are passing on the outside of the rings and causing these undulations by the effect of their own gravity. And if they exist, they would be the closest moons that known to exist around the planet because they've been found on the alpha and beta rings.
Mm.
Now, perhaps irritatingly, they haven't been able to confirm their presence visually, which suggests they might be tiny, and we're talking 4 to 14 kilometres in diameter.
Mm. Yeah.
So let's assume one of those, so you had a little Earth that was 4 kilometres, you could run around it in about an hour at a slow pace.
Yeah.
But this is really exciting because it suggests a solution to the Uranus narrow ring problem. Have you heard of that?
Yeah, it's like basically why are its rings so narrow and thin? And they think it could be the orbital effect of the moons kind of keeping it in line, keeping it in check.
Yeah, but that's the thing. You'd think that was true, except they haven't been able to find any of the moons. They only found there's only one pair of Shepherd moons that are known about, and those are Cordelia and Ophelia, which are around the Epsilon ring. But if all these teeny-weeny moons exist, then that could explain it away.
Ah, okay.
If they find these 2, and then there's potentially more,
okay,
that could explain away how these narrow. Because Saturn's rings, comparatively, are humongous. But why Uranus's rings are so inexplicably narrow has been an annoyance for astronomers for a very long time. Your bonus question at this point is about Voyager again. Which of the Voyager probes has passed through the outer boundary of our solar system and entered interstellar space? Go.
It's 50-50, isn't it? Is it Voyager 1?
It is.
Because that was because it only went to Jupiter and Saturn, and then it just kind of...
Yeah, it got on its way without bothering to stop and learn about the ice giants.
Yeah. It always confuses me, though, because 2 launched before 1 in order to be able to do that orbit, and that just... No.
I'm going to be honest, I didn't write anything down in that time, so I'm going to be honest.
You didn't write anything down. It was a choice of 1 or 2.
I know, but Ez answered before I could do anything.
Yeah,
I'm going to be honest, I can count down.
Ez is right. It's Voyager 1, which is in 2012. Voyager 2 is currently in the heliosheaf, which is the outermost region of the sun's influence, with no exact date on when it might reach interstellar space beyond a few years' time. So, your last main question is about Charon, one of those names, the largest moon of the dwarf planet Pluto, has a red stain on its north and south poles. Scientists now think they know why. So, what is the reason?
There we go.
Come on, Todd. Give you time to write it down this time.
No, I have absolutely no idea.
Ez?
No, absolutely no idea.
So the red is a substance called tholins, which is a kind of organic compound, but it started life as methane around Pluto, and then the methane escaped Pluto, but then got re-caught by Charon, that moon. And because the surface was so cold, the second that it touched down, it froze, and the sun's light converted it into this sort of ready substance that you see.
Cool.
Absolutely. Yeah, you pretty much explained it all. I don't need to do this bit. You could just do it for me. So, yeah, methane from Pluto's atmosphere that's been irradiated, basically. You know, the way this would work is Pluto lost those methane molecules. As you said, it went to the surface, froze, sublimated, left behind a hydrocarbon, irradiated, turned red, and you're right, it is a tholin. So, your bonus question then is, why did this red stain only appear on the poles?
Well, I just thought that was probably because it was cold enough there for that to happen.
Yeah, I was thinking because of the seasons on the moon that it might have been a bit colder on the poles.
You are right. You are both right. And this is the thing, it only happens on one pole at a time because of that. So the poles are the only place where the moon gets cold enough for the methane to freeze, and that's obviously only the winter pole at any one time. And bearing in mind that Pluto has a 248-year orbit, winter does go on a little while.
Winter is coming, still coming, still coming.
Basically, yes. Ian, you've been annihilated here.
Have I?
Yeah, 6-3.
Oh. Okay.
It's almost like I'm a news editor.
I was keeping score and I thought it was only 4-3, but no, never mind, that's fine.
No, it was definitely 6.
Yeah, fair play.
Hang on, you write the news for the website, though.
Yeah, well, yeah, there you go.
Homework for Ian. Right, we're going to take a break from this, and we're going to leave you in the capable hands of the Sky Night TV show's Pete Lawrence, who's going to tell us why you should take a careful look at November's full moon.
The next full moon occurs at 1353 UT on the 14th of November. And there's nothing special about that, of course. Most months get their own full moon. But what is slightly unusual is the fact that this particular full moon occurs just a couple of hours after the moon reaches a point in its orbit known as perigee. Now, perigee is a term used to describe when an object in orbit around the Earth reaches a position where the distance between it and the Earth are minimised. So the consequence of this, of course, is that if you go outside and you have a look at the full moon on the 14th of November, it will look slightly larger than it has done at any other point throughout the year when it's been at its full phase. Now, you have to take that with a pinch of salt slightly, because the apparent diameter of the moon will be tiny compared, or the difference will be tiny compared to the full moon which occurred in October and the full moon which is due to occur in December. Now, the actual apparent size will be around about 34.5 arc minutes. Compare that with the apparent size of the moon when it's next at apogee and full. That occurs sort of around May and June of 2017. Now, at that time, the moon's apparent diameter will be slightly less than 30 arc minutes across. So you see there is a difference there between 30 arc minutes and 34.5 arc minutes. But, the difference between the full moon on the 14th of November and the ones which occurred in October of this year and the one that's due to occur in December will be pretty marginal. Now, the technical term for when you get three celestial objects lined up, and that's what happens when you've got a full moon, of course, you've got the sun, the earth and the moon in alignment, is syzygy. So this particular full moon is known as a perigee syzygy full moon. Now, are there any interesting things you can do to show this particular phenomenon? Well, yes, there are. If you're an imager, you can go outside and you can take a photograph of the full moon and make a record of the kit which you've used to take the photograph. So if you've got a DSLR, for example, and you've stuck it in the back of a telescope, make a note of which telescope you've used and whether you've used any optical amplifiers, Barlows, etc., and take a photograph of the full disk of the moon. Then, when we go into next year, around May and June, take another photograph of the full moon, which occurs at that time, using the same setup, and then compare the apparent diameters of the moon you've caught with your camera. And you'll see that there is quite a noticeable difference between them. So that's one thing you can do. If you're not an imager and you just want to go out and enjoy the full moon, it's quite interesting to stare at it and try and work out what the smallest features are that you can see. Now, when you look at the face of the moon, it's very familiar to us because that's the same face that always points towards us, of course. And what you can see are the dark seas or the Maria on the moon's surface, and you can pick those out fairly well. One very noticeable one, which is actually on the, as we're looking at it from the United Kingdom, on the right-hand edge of the moon, that's actually close to the eastern limb of the moon, is Mare Crisium, which looks to us like a dark oval. See if you can pick that one out. On the other side of the moon, you've got Grimaldi, which is a tiny, tiny region if you're trying to see it with the naked eye. And I'm not sure you can actually pick that out, but it's worth going out there and having a look. If you see any photographs of the full moon, you often see that very, very impressive ray crater called Tycho, which is in the southern part of the moon. That's bright, and it's got these incredible rays which emanate out from it. So can you pick up, using just your eyes, any hint of that arrangement on the southern part of the moon? I have tried in the past, and I'm not absolutely sure that I've failed, but I'm not absolutely sure that I've succeeded either. So it's worth going out and just having a go. But whatever happens, the moon will dominate the central part of November. And unfortunately, that will mean bad news for the annual Leonid meteor display, which is set to reach its peak on the 17th of November. Can't do anything about that, so just go outside and enjoy that particular full moon. And just as a matter of interest, this will be the largest full moon we've had since the 26th of January 1948.
Okay, so our interview this episode all began with a book that landed on our desks by Margot Lee Shetterly, which was released in September, about NASA's human computers. It's called Hidden Figures, and it's specifically the story of the female African-American engineers who kind of did the behind-the-scenes calculations that enabled NASA to take part in the space race. I spoke to Dr. Christine Darden, an aeronautics engineer who worked at NASA in the 1960s, and she was part of the human computer program. So I spoke to her about her time in NASA and what it was like for a young African-American woman to seek a career in science in the 1960s, and started off by asking her how she came to work for NASA.
I originally taught school for 2 years before I went back to school to get a master's degree in applied mathematics. And when I completed my degree in applied mathematics, I applied at NASA. I think they had just been to the school recruiting, and I went to the placement office, and they said NASA was here yesterday. And so she asked me to fill out a form and send it. She would send it in. And I applied to a couple of colleges also at the same time. And actually got offers from all three and decided to go with NASA. And so that's actually how I got there.
When you worked at NASA, you were one of the so-called human computers. I was wondering if you could tell us exactly who were the human computers and what was their role?
Okay. The human computers were generally women, and they actually started, I think, back in the, well, maybe in the 1930s, but certainly in the early 40s, who were hired to do the mathematical calculations of equations that the engineers worked with. Once they had their equations, they would often sit down with a mechanical calculator and large spreadsheets and calculate the dependent variables based on what the independent variables were in the equations. And the engineers would use these certainly for their analysis and for their technical reports. The women also actually created the figures. This was, of course, before the computers were there. The mechanical computers were there to draw figures and label figures and things like that. So there were actually women in the computer offices who created the figures and diagrams for technical reports that NASA put out. There were films that were created in the wind tunnels that generated data for the research also. And so some of the women actually went down to the tunnel area and read the key data points off the film for the analysis that the engineers were doing. So there was a variety of work that was done. Now, I was hired about 20 years later. I was hired about 2 years before they walked on the moon. And so I had actually... computers were coming into NASA by then, and I had actually had a little training in programming before I came. And so I started doing more of writing computer programs for engineers to bring into the room. They would often derive the equations that they wanted solved, and they would just bring them in and say, would you write a computer program for this? To give me the dependent variables that I would, you know, need to know. And so I did mostly that when I was in the computer group. I was there for about 5 years. The computer section had been a segregated section before I was there. So I actually worked with some of the ladies who had worked in this segregated computer group, but I never did. The office was mixed when I was hired, and so I never experienced that aspect of the computer group. So that was sort of my experience working there, with mostly working on computer programs that engineers brought into the office to be solved.
And I have to ask you, really, because it's the subject of Margot Lee Shetterly's book, but even though you weren't working in a segregated environment, what was it like for a young African-American woman in the 1960s to try and pursue a career in science?
Well, one of the first things that happened to me was when I went off to college, I told my father that I wanted to major in general studies, which meant I would not take the education courses to allow me to be a teacher. And he told me that if he was going to send me to college, I had to take education. I had to get a teacher certificate because he wanted me to be able to get a job when I got out. And so that's why I went into teacher education, because there were not very many jobs for African American women. Teachers, nurses, secretaries were about the extent, unless you worked in somebody's kitchen, you know, or in their home as sort of a personal servant. And that's, of course, why I taught for 2 years. I didn't get any other jobs, so I took a job as a teacher for 2 years. And once I got to NASA, I really didn't know what the engineers did until I really got there and saw them, what they brought into the office. And I did not really understand the problems that they were working on, because they often didn't share to a great depth what they were working on. They would just bring the equations. So once I really found out how they were working, and my love and my preparation and everything in the physical sciences and applied mathematics, I sort of thought, gee, I could be doing what they're doing, and started to actually ask about, you know, well, could I transfer out of the computer section, you know, to an engineering section, or could I go to school and take more engineering classes so I could do that? And So the outside atmosphere was certainly difficult as far as jobs being open, and it was a good job. Even in the computer pool, it was a good job to have at the time for an African-American woman.
Hmm. And I suppose it's safe to say that without the work of you and your colleagues, we may never have landed humans on the moon, or you know, the successes enjoyed by NASA in the 60s and 70s, but probably wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for people like yourself and your colleagues.
Well, I did not do very much in preparing for the moon. The section that I went to work in was called reentry physics, and they did do all of the calculations for the Apollo vehicle to reenter the atmosphere. I was more in a sort of a hypersonic atmospheric flow area. And so all of the problems that a vehicle encounters coming into the atmosphere, the angle that it has to come in, the temperatures that it encounters when it comes back in the atmosphere, they had done all of that work for the Apollo before I got there. And so, you know, they were really getting ready to fly by the time I got there. But certainly the ladies that were there in the 40s and 50s was certainly, well, the late 50s, I guess, and 60s after it became NASA. Certainly those ladies, and certainly Katherine Johnson, who worked in the flight controls area, who actually calculated some of the trajectories. She played a great role in getting man to the moon and having them trust the numbers that would get them to the moon.
Yes, I think books like this and stories like this really have a lot to teach us.
That's absolutely true. And we are continually trying to get our young girls to go into science. We still have a difficulty, I think, encouraging them to do that. But we strive to make them get prepared in doing so. It was an extremely rewarding career, and one in which, and I often tell students when I talk to them, it was a job in which you were excited to get up and go to work every day. I didn't do one thing all the time. I wrote papers, I gave papers, I did experimental tests, I wrote computer programs, I advocated for programs and for money for the programs. And so every day was different, and every day, you know, brought on new challenges and new satisfactions and everything. And so I try to convey that to the young people also, that often in these careers, it's a passion within you that, you know, of the work you're doing, and it is so great, and it's challenging, and it's absolutely not boring. And if you see your research and work come to fruition, it is absolutely exhilarating.
So all that's left is for us to tell you about what's coming up in the November issue of BBC Sky at Night magazine. We'll be looking at how scientists hope to tackle one of the most exciting questions in the solar system at the moment, which is there life on Europa, after new images revealed even more plumes coming out of it. We will be explaining how astronomers can map the Milky Way without actually leaving it, because of course we can't. And that's one you wrote, isn't it, Ezzy?
Yes, it is. It's surprisingly difficult that even though the Milky Way is the galaxy that we are closest to being in it, this is unfortunately makes it quite problematic to map, because imagine you were sitting in your house, all you can see around you is the walls of your living room. What does the rest of your house look like?
Or indeed the outside of your house.
Or the outside of your house, all of these kinds of things. And so it's about looking into that question of how do they work out what our home galaxy looks like, considering we're sat inside it.
Plus, we will be revealing how you can star hop around the clusters and globules of another galaxy, our neighbour M31, in what is our first extragalactic astronomy tour.
Nice.
And also, I need to tell you about our monthly sky guide, new and improved with extra sections.
It's very shiny looking.
Very shiny looking. new sections in there. We are doing a star of the month feature, which covers variable and multiple stars. We have got an in-depth piece on comets, meteors, or asteroids. We have a new challenge every month. Mm-hmm. So in case you were, you know,
You don't just want to see, you want to test yourself. You can do that as well. And we've also introduced a little family stargazing section. So if you have little ones and you want to show them night sky, we can point out easy targets and fun facts to capture their imaginations. Plus, we've got our regular bonus content.
Yeah, a bit of a 2016 retrospective, this issue's bonus content. I spoke to David Parker, who's Director of Human Spaceflight and Robotic Exploration at ESA, just kind of discussing how the UK has contributed to spaceflight and exploration over the year.
Brilliant. BBC Sky at Night magazine is available in print and several digital formats. Find out more at skynightmagazine.com/subscribe or look out for us in your digital newsstand or app store. This has been Radio Astronomy. We have been BBC Sky Night magazine, and we'll be back in a month's time.